Welcome to Master the Start, a podcast for young professionals where we interview business experts on how you can master the start of your life in business.
Welcome back, everyone, to this week's episode of Master the Start, presented by GoMahi.com. This is the 31st episode of Master the Start, and like always, I will be your host of this wonderful journey. I'm Bobby Mason, and I'm so excited to start this week's episode because we have an amazing guest. More like an amazing guest. That's a proper grammatical term. Anyways, we have Jim Watkins on the show today, and I know I've said it in the past, but I have to say this was probably one of my favorite episodes. He was so open about his business, and I think you're going to learn a lot. If you are a student of business at all, you are truly going to love this episode. So I'm going to give you a little context here. It's not really nearly as much about Jim as it is about his journey, because I don't think Jim would really care about how we introduce him as much as what he's built. So Jim is actually one of the founders of Sociable Ciderworks. So he started this thing as an idea, and he always thought that it'd be laughable to have an outing with his employees. Because at the time when he started this thing, he was working 90-hour weeks where all three of the people that were kind of working on this project, Sociable Ciderworks, they were packaging, they were producing, they were selling, they were bartending, they were accounting. And the last thing they really needed to think about was team bonding. But now his tap room, in a small amount of time, 5 years to be exact, has actually gone from three of them to 29 employees. So for the first time ever, he's actually trying to figure out how to capture the essence of who they were back on that Madison Street garage. I just gave you a little context there because we're gonna go in depth into how he started the company, how that journey is looking, and how he creates that company culture and sustains it through the current growth phase of his company. I don't know if I was very specific there. I tried to keep it pretty broad, but his journey is incredible. This episode, honestly, it's incredible. Let's jump into this podcast. Settle in. Make sure you subscribe to the podcast. Actually, you know what? I'm going to say all of that at the end of this episode because I just want to get right into it. We'll talk to you at the end of the show. All right, Jim. Thank you for joining us on the Master the Start podcast. We're honored to have you on the show. I guess we're ready to just hop on in.
Yeah.
All right.
Thanks for having me on. Excited to be a part of it.
Of course. So we like to start with just the backstory of who each guest is. So who is Jim Watkins and what is Sociable Ciderworks?
Boy, starting with the heady questions. All right. Yeah. So who is Jim Watkins? I'm a budding entrepreneur, the managing director and co-founder of Sociable Ciderworks. I try not to define myself just by my work, but so I'm married to a lovely woman who's, we're expecting our first baby here in 3 weeks.
Congrats.
So soon to be a father and, yeah, I'm avid windsurfer, outdoorsman, and I like to thinker about things that are happening in the world and society, et cetera.
Fair enough. To dive in a little more, explain Sociable Ciderworks for all of us so we can dive a little deeper into that company and people have some context.
Yeah, so Sociable is we're a 5-year-old cidery. We're a very unique business. We're one of the only cider companies in the country that's licensed as a brewery, rather as a winery. And we can talk more about that later if you'd like to. But the gist of it is that we make a lot of really kind of fun, unique beverages. And our business has kind of evolved to include our taproom retail component has become, you know, more and more important in terms of how we articulate the brand, et cetera. And so we spent some time thinking, you know, are we a cider company or are we a beverage company or are we, are we an entertainment company? And I think that, you know, we think very much about how we fit relative to our customers and our fans. And we very much feel like we're part of the entertainment business or we're people are spending their time, their free time and their money with us. And so guest experience for us is the most important thing, whether that's delivering a new, unique product, something that someone's never tasted before, or if that's hosting an event on a Saturday with a band that that someone's a fan of. So we're a customer experience business and one that happens to manufacture delicious widgets.
So how big are you guys after 5 years?
We are on pace to do about 8,000 barrels of liquid volume this year. That makes us relative to big beer that they probably spill more than we will produce in a year. But in Minnesota, we're a reasonably large player. We're right around the 10th largest by volume of breweries in the States, and we are I would say maybe in the top quartile of cideries nationally in terms of the amount of volume they make. And right now we're distributing only in Minnesota and a little bit of volume in North Dakota. We're just now starting to do some homework on pushing our product into new markets.
I think the reason I really asked that is because I'd still describe you as a startup to a small business, right?
Yeah, I think that's accurate. Yep.
So you're still very familiar with that startup world. So I kind of actually want to dive into your past and kind of figure out what it's like to start a company. So the first question I kind of want to get into is, Wade was the individual that founded the company with you, correct?
Yep, correct.
So how did you and Wade become a team?
So Wade and I have been friends since we were 18. We went to college together. Interesting tidbit, Wade lived on the same floor as my now wife, freshman year in college. And Wade was on we went to Carleton College down in Northfield, Minnesota, and he was on a football team down there, and my roommate was also on the football team. So we kind of ran with the same kind of group of guys. And after we graduated, we were friends all through college. We studied abroad together. We were, we both did semesters at the London School of Economics. And then when my first job out of school was working for Citibank out in New York, and Wade was working at Piper Jaffray, and he started in the Twin Cities office, but then got transferred out to New York, and he was my roommate out there. So we had very different schedules, investment banker schedule. Like, you know, those guys don't really think about getting up till 10 a.m., but they work until all hours in the morning, whereas I was on the trading desk. So, you know, my day started a lot earlier. So it was the perfect roommate relationship. You know, you always, both of us had the apartment to ourselves during our respective hours. But yeah, we stayed friends all through New York, and we'd kind of daydream and talk about the idea of starting our own shop, like, you know, moving back home and doing something that was where we were, you know, busting our butts to the same level, but for ourselves versus for somebody else. And we weren't sure exactly what that would look like. When we ended up back in Minnesota, we started doing some home brewing and home distilling as people do. And we really started to think about whether or not we could make that a business. And so we, it took us 63 iterations of our Excel model before we decided that it was a good idea. And on that 63rd iteration, we thought, all right, I think we can do this. We held a retirement party for Wade and it was off to the races.
That's crazy. So was there one specific point that you and Wade were kind of complaining about the lightly alcoholic made from concentrate sweet ciders on the shelves? That's your kind of quote from your site.
Yeah. That's a good question. So like in terms of like, you know, what was the inciting incident for this? So it's, interestingly, we didn't start doing this with the intent of like opening a business. This was just, we were experimenting in the garage, what we wanted to taste new and interesting things. And so we were making everything. And we started making some ciders based on a recipe that Wade's father-in-law had perfected over probably 20 plus years of home cider making experience. And his name is Dan. And Dan was making these great kind of Northern French style, dry, bubbly, like I'm talking no residual sugar. Like they could easily be mistaken for champagne. And that stuff was like currency in the Thompson and Penny households. Like if Dan brought over a case of cider, you wanted to go home with one of them. And so we started, kind of riffing off of his recipe and coming up with new, interesting ways to make it better with the ingredients that we had available for us. These kind of, the typical Midwestern table apples. And that's when we started experimenting with brewing in a bittering component to the ciders. And we just kept going back to that because it was so interesting. So it wasn't like we were complaining about the other ciders that were out there. We just weren't drinking them. And so then we were drinking the stuff that Dan was making and the stuff that we were making. And it very much became a question of, man, this stuff is fantastic. Like, why were we not exploring this category before? And the answer was, it just wasn't that appealing. And you know, at the time, I think that was back when the Strongbow original recipe was still available. That was probably the closest thing you could get. And we had kind of learned about that while studying abroad in the UK. So we thought that a more European kind of drier adult take on cider could really work here. And it wasn't, we didn't do any research groups. We didn't do any like market studies. I mean, we knew what the market for cider was because we had access to some deal books that had via our investment banking background. But it was much more a product driven decision. Like, this is something that we really like. We think it's really interesting, and we think there's other people that have similar taste preferences just based on the craft beer boom that was happening. And so it's just things kind of aligned for us unintentionally. In fact, we originally thought we were going to open a distillery. That was our first crack at modeling up a beverage business. The kind of stars seemed to align. Like, just a series of things happened that made us feel like cider was the right move. And like I said, it was all driven very much by the fact that we were making this stuff that we love that we couldn't find in the liquor stores.
You just brought up market study, and I got to imagine your guys' 8,000-mile road trip was a little bit of a study on the market.
Yeah,
what was that?
That's a good point. So I joke about this all the time at Sociable. Like, we're never going to be a focus group-driven company, largely because I feel like when you make the kind of stuff that we make, which is interesting. I mean, we have a cider that has cucumber and habanero in it. Like, that on paper, that does not work. But it's one of our most interesting, one of the most interesting things that we make. And it's an example of a product that people didn't know they need or wanted until we put it in front of them. And so I typically think that things that are designed in focus groups are exactly that, the least common denominator. And for us, that trip was a way for us to kind of get our, like, really kind of understand what these businesses looked like kind of on the ground, if you will. Like, what were the nuances of a business, a craft distillery in Little Rock, Arkansas versus a craft cidery in Portland, Oregon? And what were those places doing well? And for us, it was really a survey of the retail experience and thinking about, how do we build this brand? How do we build this business? What can we pick up some, can we pick up some technical pointers along the way, which we did. This is a remarkably, craft beverage in general is just a remarkably collaborative space. I think it's because the purveyors of these businesses feel like what they're doing is an art form a little bit. And so there isn't this like, well, that's my recipe. I don't want you to rip that off. It's much more of a, that's my expression of a pale ale, for example. Like, what's your expression of a pale ale? And then because the brands have been strong and the consumer facing part and people have kind of a personal vested stake in some of these local producers, you can carve out a brand space with very few resources. You know, you don't have to have Super Bowl ad money to be able to do this and to be able to speak to a consumer that's excited about what we're doing.
So how long did that road trip take?
We were on the road for about 30 days. It was actually my wife and I got married in May, and then we did our honeymoon, and I got back and, like, 3 days later, Wade and I like loaded the truck up and started on that trip. So she's a remarkably good sport about that. But it was really important for us to, in terms of formulating our plan. And we came up with the brand name while we were on that trip, and the theme. You know, we used this urban bicycle theme to kind of tie the brand together, largely because we're both pretty avid cyclists, and we wanted something that was fun and kind of was an expression of who we are and the experience that we were living in Minneapolis.
So just for even a little deeper context, how did you guys essentially pay for your lives at that point? Did you already have a bunch saved up when you decided to take this leap into entrepreneurship?
Yeah, so Wade was still working but I should give you some more context for my like career path. So Wade was at Piper Jaffray for, I think, 5 or 6 years, maybe a little longer. I worked at Citi for just shy of 3. And then, When Wade moved back to Minneapolis, my then girlfriend, now wife, moved back to Minneapolis. She was out in New York as well. And I actually like went down to Miami for 2 years and taught some high school math. And so I was, before, when I came back to Minneapolis, I was very much thinking I was going to go back to business school. And so I was studying for the GMAT and for the GRE. And when you take that test, you know, they ask you, when you take the specifically GMAT, there's the question on there that says, would you like to be contacted by business schools? And I clicked yes. That was the whole purpose of taking that test. And so some of the organizations that can contact you are actually test prep companies. And so I scored well enough that there was I got contacted by a test prep company, and I was actually, so while I was I would joke with friends that I was in between jobs. Like, after I had moved back to Minneapolis, I didn't have a full-time gig. I was teaching GMAT and GRE prep. And then also I mentioned that I'm an avid windsurfer. I was doing some windsurfing lessons on the side. So teaching windsurfing and kiteboarding in Minnesota. So I had a extremely flexible schedule. But also, you know, they're historically, if you're a 22-year-old kid, the best place to get paid was Wall Street. And that was, we kind of caught that. We graduated in 2007. And so we were on the desk. Both of us were on the desk during the kind of heart of the financial crisis and the mortgage meltdown. And we were able to have squirreled away enough dough to be able to start this project.
Wow. How long did it take you to kind of save up for the project?
Yeah, well, I mean, in terms of like the total funding, we had a very difficult time getting debt out of the chute. So it was, we bootstrapped everything, man. It was like, pretty much every piece of equipment we bought was used. Our first fermenters were from Two Town Cider House out in Corvallis, Oregon. And they had purchased them from a winemaker in Northern California. So we didn't get secondhand gear. We got third hand gear. And so it was one of those things where we had, you know, the whole, when you send Midwestern boy to New York City to work on an investment banking desk or a trading desk, it's very like the mentality that pervades is one of, all right, I'm here to squirrel away as much money as possible. This is not a career. And I think that is, it's very unique to talk to a lot of, a lot of kids from kind of Midwestern or like what have traditionally been kind of deemed flyover states that end up on the East Coast to work in these like financial services jobs, or even like ones that move to the West Coast now and work in tech. Like, there's been a pretty big shift in terms of where that talent has been going. And it's very, there's very much a view that it's like, hey, this is something that I'm doing to be able to do my next project. And for me, you know, I grew up in an entrepreneurial family. Like, my first business was spreading fire ant killing bait as a like 14-year-old. And so I always knew that I was going to start my own business. So working at Citi was kind of a pathway to be able to do that.
Gotcha. That makes a lot of sense. And you just brought up how you had used everything, used equipment. Where did you guys make your first batch of cider?
406 Madison Street, Northeast Minneapolis. It was, I was living at the time in the med school version of Animal House. My wife was living with four other medical students, all of whom we are still close with now and are actually like real doctors now. They've made it through that path. And so I was the sixth roommate in that scenario. So Annie had, my wife's name is Annie, and she paid a little bit extra every month to have a parking spot in the garage. And that space quickly got co-opted and turned into our kind of cider mill / brew house. And it was, I like working with my hands, and I grew up welding and building things. And so we had a really like a miniaturized version of what we wanted our commercial space to look like in the garage. And it was a lot of fun. It was a great spot to spend the afternoon, probably drinking one or two too many beers and experimenting with flavors and thinking about what the business could look like.
Can you talk about the first sale you had and that moment and how you delivered it?
Yeah, the first sale. So I have a couple great first sale stories. So the first one was, when I say we bootstrapped this thing, I mean, I've got even our warehouse was, or like our space, our production space right now was a boarded up old kind of junky warehouse. And so everything, we power washed the walls. We ended up painting, we ended up doing all the seal coating, like anything that we could do ourselves to save some money to be able to get the project off the ground, we did. And so, I mean, we were at one point when we were new tenants, the police stopped in and thought Wade was trespassing. That's how late we'd be there till 3-4 o'clock in the morning. In the week leading up to our actual open, we opened on Black Friday, the day after Thanksgiving. And so the week before, we're in the space getting everything ready, and we'd gotten licensed and everything, but weren't open to the public yet, but we're still in there like making sure the point of sale was all set up and et cetera. And these fellas from across the way were over at a softball field, and they walked in like, are you open? And we said, no, we're technically not even a business yet. We're like, we've never opened. And they said, well, will you pour us a couple pints? And so we ended up kind of telling these guys our story, and we gave them our first ever tour we did. And they paid with the point of sale system wasn't even up. I couldn't even ring them up. And so they said, you know, what do we owe you? I said, nothing. I can't even ring you up. You just come back, tell your friends about this, come back when we open. And the kind of leader of their gang left a $100 bill. He said, hold on to this. This is going to be the memory of your first sale. And I still have that $100 bill.
That is a great story.
It wasn't even a sale. It was, and honestly, like, that kind of captures a little bit of the mission of Sociable, which is, you know, let's focus on the product and the quality and the experience first. And then hopefully the money will come. That was kind of a good reminder that, okay, give people a great experience. And even if you don't ask them for money, maybe they'll give it to you.
So you start having a little more success. What were the most important decisions you think you guys made? And what were the poor decisions you made? What kind of shaped how the business was done?
Yeah. Oh man, I could teach a freshman seminar on poor decisions. I think that part of starting a business and running one and particularly like managing a building full of young people, right? We're learning as you go and making mistakes that aren't going to sink the business so that you can get better. And I think that we made a lot of those. I'll give you a couple examples, but let's focus on the good first. The things that we did really well is, you know, Wade and I were very, very deliberate about how we structured our business. And we are perfectly matched 50-50 partners. And we have a provision in the company that doesn't allow one of us to take the other one out so if, for example, over the course of the first 5 years, there's been times when I've had to contribute capital or when Wade's having to contribute capital and the other party was not able to do so, that always comes with a catch-up provision for us. So against the better of advice of a lot of our advisors, we decided where there was not going to be a like point person, like CEO position. And then operations or CFO position. So we split the business perfectly evenly. And that took a lot of time and thinking about, right, how are we going to structure this in a way that's not going to be crippling? You know, we don't have a tie break. One of the things that we thought about is structuring our leadership roles in a way that like really fit our specific skill sets. And so, I'm responsible for everything. So we determined to split the product or the business at the finished product. And so Wade is, we make all these decisions together, but Wade has ultimate jurisdiction over everything upstream. So that's sourcing. That's how the production facilities run. That's the point of sale system that we're going to use. And then I have responsibility for everything downstream. So all the consumer facing stuff, all the sales and marketing, all the distribution relationships. And so what it created was a scenario where we would, on decisions that were squarely in one of those boxes, you know, we'd be able to use the other as a sounding board. Like, what do you think about this? And then be able to make the decision that we thought was best. And so there was times when I'd say to Wade, hey man, I really disagree with your tack on this, but that's your ultimate decision. You know that part of the business far better than I could. And vice versa. There's certainly times when, you know, I make a decision about something that's consumer facing or marketing related that Wade disagrees with. And there's been times when I ultimately like defer and say, okay, well, the fact that Wade doesn't disagree with this, I don't want to move forward on it unless he does. And then there's been times where I have moved forward and then you have to kind of deal with the consequences of it not going well or going well. And so there's a level of accountability there. It's really interesting. It's like, it's almost like you want to make a decision if you make a decision that your business partner doesn't agree with, you've got to own it and it has to be right. And so you have to have 100% conviction to do that. Otherwise you're swimming upstream when it's time to kind of like revisit that, that particular component of the business. And so, you know, perfect example is for that is like rolling out or marketing a new product. If I have a lot of conviction for something, I'm thinking about one product and specifically Spoke Wrench, which is a like heavy malt adjunct product. It's super interesting. We got a lot of press for it. It did a lot of things great for us, but it just was kind of a dog in a liquor store shelves. And so that has kind of like influenced my decision to move forward on products that Wade wasn't super excited about because that was one of them. And to ask the question like, all right, am I making the right decision on something that ultimately didn't work the last time? And so it really forces you to think about, you know, why your partner disagrees with you and what the and what the needs are to make sure that you have consensus going into decisions where you're going to be, outlaying capital.
I love your guys' way of structuring how you and Wade work together. That is amazing. I wish my partner in crime and I were a little better at that, for sure, because we like to bounce a lot of things off of each other and get each other's approval, which I think is important. But having someone that ultimately has the power to make a decision in that position, I think that's also super important.
It's really, yeah. And I think that, like, the unintended consequence of it, you know, we thought a lot about, you know, what does this mean? And Wade and I were friends first. So, like, preserving a friendship is very important. And I think there's a lot of business partners where that can fade. If you built a business on a friendship rather than, you know, like a sound, you know, understanding the other person is bringing some value to the table that you're not able to do, like, then it can break down really quickly. And so for us, it was about me recognizing that, all right, I'm not an operations guy. I think about things in a more macro way. And I'm a lot more forward looking, and I got, you know, it's my job to generate new ideas and push the forward, like, to develop the business moving forward. And vice versa, you know, Wade's very conservative in terms of how he thinks about things. He'll playing cards with him is, like, one of the most painful, like, things of all time. He is so deliberate in his thinking and strategy. It's for me, it's like remarkably stifling. But boy, you want to talk about a dynamic pair for somebody that typically shoots first and asks questions later. Like, you know, having someone that's spending time thinking about, you know, what the implications of those decisions are is a great sounding board. It's a great way to kind of temper my enthusiasm, and vice versa. You know, me being out there kind of hammering at the next project is a way to have Wade thinking, you know, forward looking, as opposed to, hey, this is, well, I'm just focused on maximizing the, you know, the operational efficiencies of what we have right now.
So what are the bad decisions that you kind of ran into?
Oh, man. Well, I mean, first of all, we've reorganized the brewery 4 times in terms of, like, physical space. So we just didn't, you know, you kind of build your space thinking about what your business is now and not what it's going to be. And I think that that's the safe decision, right? But it's every time it bites us in the rear. That's a really difficult thing and we're just starting to figure that out, is how do we create something that functions really smoothly right now that has an outlet for growth? And so it's almost like planning for the worst case scenario, but expecting the best case scenario. So you're hedged to the downside, but you're able to grow when it's time to grow. And, you know, we put ourselves in a situation where we didn't have enough space when it was time to grow. We had this whole scenario where we had another tenant in our building that was next door. And so we, like, ran out of office space. And then we were in a situation where we had to exercise our option on the space. And then that guy left, and it ended up costing us probably $100,000 to, like, redo his office space in a way that fit for our business. And that was all largely driven by the fact that we were undercapitalized when we started. We couldn't make a forward-looking plan. We had to kind of work with what we had. And similarly, like, you know, we had a leased brew house when we started. Like, that was a horrible use of capital, but it was only $1,000 a month. And at the time, that's what we had. And so we made a lot of decisions that were not the best. They weren't decisions that optimized the growth of the company or the future outlook. It was just kind of decisions we made because we felt like we didn't have any other options. And looking back on it now, you know, there's some things that we could have done from a financing perspective. And certainly now we're more bankable. So it just seems like our access to capital is a little bit more fluid. So it's easy to say those were bad decisions, kind of looking back at them. You know, the hindsight is indeed 20/20. But also, it's really difficult to answer the question, like, what would we have done? What would we have done better in that scenario without the capital? And I think that's a really difficult thing to put yourself back in those shoes and say, okay, what were our constraints? And so I think that now we are making decisions in a way that's a lot more deliberate. It's a lot more, you know, thinking about what does the system need to be for this to happen. So, you know, the first kegs that we delivered, I put in the truck and drove there, and, you know, I was making it and I was delivering it and I was selling it. And we didn't think about, you know, what the sustainability of that was, or what the implication for a founder that was doing, you know, that breadth of work. And then all of a sudden you have to hire staff to do those things because, you know, my capacity to do that, we diminished as the business grew. And so we just didn't have, you know, we didn't have the structure in place. And now we're, you know, you mentioned when we started that we're kind of still in startup land to small business. And that's been a really interesting transition. We are transitioning from being a startup, which is, you know, bootstrap, you know, all hands on deck, everybody wears all hats. We just got to get this thing open and make sure the concept works. As an aside, that happened to be my favorite part of the business. but now we're transitioning to thinking a little bit more strategically about, okay, what is it that we need to do to get to where we want to be? And how do we, you know, make decisions that maybe aren't optimized for this moment, but it could be optimized for, you know, for the path that we're going, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. It makes perfect sense. What are the biggest challenges then in this growth phase? Are you getting into the small business world, and how do you really keep that company culture strong? Because you guys seem to have a pretty unique culture, and I'm assuming that's been one of the keys to your quick growth. So how do you continue that with, I'm assuming you've grown dramatically in your team size.
Yep.
So how do you do that?
Gosh, that's a great question. And it's something that I think about literally every day. Cause when you're three guys sitting around a coffee table in the back of a warehouse, your company culture is the interplay of your three personalities, right? There, you can write something down on paper, but at the end of the day, you know, you're the three human beings that are back there working. And so as then, like, I feel like I blinked and then we woke up and we've got 22 full-time employees, and that's a, things get lost in translation because I can't interact with them. Like, I can't, you know, the sociable part of the business, like, that's a big part of my personality also. Like, I can't influence them directly every single day, every single moment. So we have to think really hard about what it is that we do to articulate this vision to people. And so we've recently implemented EOS. Are you familiar with that operating system?
Yes, but for our audience, tell us a little bit about it.
Yeah, so it's based on the book Traction. If anybody gets a chance to read it, I would recommend it. It's in its most distilled form, it's a goal setting and accountability program that you can put in for small businesses. And so you know, you set a 10 and 5 and 3 and 1 year plan, and then you kind of break that down into kind of quarterly objectives for each of your like key personnel. And for us as a small business, like, all personnel is key. And so a big part of that for us was defining the business, not in terms of, you know, revenue or liquid units that we move or market position, but in terms of, like, what it is that we actually want to be culturally. And so we kind of really, like, we had to go back and distill down these things that, I don't want to say they happened on accident because they were deliberate, but these things that happened very organically. And then we had to go back and actually define those and say, okay, here's how we here's what we did that caused us to get here. And now let's systemize that to make sure that happens. So, you know, we focus on kind of three things at Sociable, and that's to have fun. This is a beverage business. So that is the number one thing on our agenda. Like, there's a reason why I'm not an investment banker anymore. And so, you know, have fun is top of mind for all of our staff. To do good is number two. We've never turned down a request from a not-for-profit for product or donations. That's a big part of how we branded and marketed the company. We have all sorts of great partnerships with great organizations in and around the Twin Cities that has really helped us become a part of the community. It's been so core to who we are that do good's a really important part of that. And then to produce quality, and whether that's producing, like, having a wonderfully produced, like, summer concert in our parking lot, which we have a great series out here that goes great, or making a pink cider for the summertime that people talk about because it's so interesting and innovative and interesting. And so that quality component becomes, like, the driver for everything we do as a as production staff and as taproom staff and all those things. So, you know, the implementation of EOS has been really great for us because it forced us to stop and say, okay, we've just been, like, chicken with a head cut off, like, you know, squeaky wheel gets the grease, kind of go, go, go mode for 5 years. Now let's think about what do we need to do to get this ship pointed in the 10-year direction, and how do we get there in a way that's sustainable and doesn't burn our people out.
I kind of think this next question will piggyback off of that. What really motivates you when it comes to your entrepreneurial ambitions, and what do you actually hope to see Sociable essentially do in the future?
Yeah. So for me, the part of it that is the most fun is the building it part. And I don't know, I don't know what it is, like, why I'm wired that way. Do I love being able to kind of come up with an idea for a product, then craft that product and taste it, and then kind of reiterate until I get it to exactly how I imagine it in my brain? like, yeah, certainly. Like that is a, that's a big part of it. That is the, and there, that takes a specific type of creativity, like kind of technically minded creativity. But that is, that part is just like, you know, that is the, you know, the product on which you build something that's bigger than that. And so for me, the building it has been really fun. The, like the going from being a kind of two person and, you know, quickly after that third person, like garage operation effectively, into something that has some staying power, some sustainability. And so the growth of that has been most interesting from my perspective is, it's like, we're like building this little mini, like this little mini empire over here, right? We're making, I mean, shoot, we're making mead now. We have plans to do kombucha. So it's like, it's just, that growth part of the, it has been what's been most interesting for me. And in terms of, you know, what does sociable look like in 10 or 15 or 20 or, you know, 30 years, if it has that type of staying power in the market, for me, it's about creating a space that is, that can be multi-generational. Like we did not build this to sell. We use freshly pressed apples. That's, if you want to sell a cider business, you're supposed to use juice concentrate. It, like sourcing fresh produce is a colossal pain in the rear. We have an employee comp bonus pool that amounts to almost 20% of the company. If you want to turn around and sell this business to somebody, you don't do that. But if you want to have employees that are young that come in here and take ownership, like literal, like take ownership of what it is that they're doing and feel like they're invested in the long-term health of the brand and want to build a career here, like we want to make this a place where they can do that. And so, you know, some of the other things that we've done this year, like the beer business and the services business in general is notoriously underpaid. And that's still the case at Sociable. We're still very much from a wage and compensation perspective, still very much in startup mode. I mean, shoot, I still only pay myself $35,000 a year. And so some of the things that we have to think about is, all right, how do we put in structures and systems that make our employees want to help grow this thing so that when I'm gone, if I get hit by a bus, it still perpetuates. And so we're like very, very proud that we now offer full health care benefits to all of our employees. And we have a matching 401k program. That's pretty unheard of for a business of our size and certainly in our industry right now.
That's awesome. That's really, really awesome. You guys definitely live and work in a way that you're sociable. You make a big difference too. That's super cool. So much respect for that.
Yeah, I appreciate that, man. We like I said, it's deliberate. Like we're really thinking about how we can be kind of a lasting part of this community and frankly, like part of the communities that we're going to enter. Like we're talking about self-distributing some product in Wisconsin this year. And so we are being very deliberate to think about like, what does sociable mean? What does being sociable in the Wisconsin market look like? And how can we be, you know, how can we be members of the community there and develop those relationships the way that we did here?
So I have a few more questions for you before the quick fire, if you have time.
Yeah, absolutely.
Sweet. So let's rewind the story for a quick moment. You tested a ton of batches. I'm more specifically 63 at the inception of the company.
There was more batches than that, but that was the number you're referring to is the number of models that we put together before we decided this was a sound financial plan.
Gotcha. So how did you test those batches? Did you get consumer feedback on those? Was a lot of the feedback emotional from your own standpoint? How did you move forward with specific products?
That is a fantastic question. So we made some really, really crummy products when we were starting, as everyone does, right? You're learning, you're kind of figuring this process out. You know, our flagship product, we brew sorghum into. Sorghum is notoriously high in tannin and it has almost a metallic flavor when you use too much of it. So we made some ciders that tasted like pennies, man. And our friends drank every drop of them. you quickly realize as you start to iterate these things, like that's the, what we did there, like very meticulous and kind of tracking what it is we did to achieve the results we had. All right, what we did there, that's repeatable. What we did over there, that should not be repeatable. We should avoid that. And so the stuff that wasn't worth saving or thinking of like, or replicating, we just feed to our friends and they're for the most part, like willing consumers. But what really like the first time we ever really got like meaningful consumer feedback is when we were still very much in startup mode, I started taking cider to people's weddings as gifts. And so we had a good little draft set up. And so we'd show up with a couple corny kegs and a draft set up and we'd pour cider for people. Oh, we wouldn't pour. We just set it out and people would pour their own. And we went, I went to like three or four weddings in a row where we took this stuff and it was like the first thing to go. It was cracked in no time. And this is like people, you know, I was obviously part of the wedding, but this wasn't like our core group of friends. This was like other random people that were just crushing this stuff. And it was, feels really good when you put something out and you don't, people are consuming it without you standing there. If you're standing there, you just, especially in the Midwest, like people are going to be Minnesota nice to you. Like, and, but to watch other people consume it that don't know what it is and to like it, was really reaffirming. And it said, okay, like this could indeed have legs. And so that was kind of what we used as kind of the, I don't know, I guess the encouragement to kind of keep pushing towards finding commercial space and doing the thing full time.
That is a brilliant way of testing things. I think you added something really important. The fact that you weren't standing there, that's huge when you're testing a product.
Yeah. I mean, when's the last time you heard someone tell somebody that their homebrew is shit? it doesn't happen. Like nobody's going to do that. And like maybe now as the market gets more sophisticated and the other part of that too is, you know, what we find in this space is there's a lot of people that are big fans of quality cider, quality beer, quality wine that don't really know what they're tasting. They just know if they like it or not. And so, and there's some examples, some commercial examples of products that are technically flawed that still sell very well. And so, and then there's other examples of products that are technically flawless that don't sell very well. And so it's, you can't separate the marketing component or the sociable component, right? The personality part. If I'm standing there, like I'm a good salesperson, I will convince somebody that they're going to like it before they even taste it. And then, so to separate from that and ask the question, like, does this stand on its own? That was the most stressful part. You know, the most uncertain is like you're releasing this thing into the world and how does it do if you're not standing there holding its hand?
Yeah, definitely. I think of kind of everything you've said to this point and thinking about how sociable set up. And I have to ask a question that I'm just curious about now. Does emotion intervene a lot on yours and Wade's business decisions or does it not? And how do you kind of balance the emotional standpoint of how to do things right and kind of how you want to change the industry and essentially making a decision based off of what's just financially the right thing to do?
I'm going to use the word better, say we're getting better at that, but it might actually, from a different perspective, it might actually be that we're getting worse. But when we first started, it was all emotion, right? Like sure, we wanted to not go broke, right? I guess there's, but that's also a very emotional decision, right? Like, I mean, leaving lucrative banking jobs is an emotional decision, right? That's not like logically, that doesn't make sense. You leave a job with great benefits. Like, so it comes down to like understanding what your personal utility is versus like your personal dollars, right? Like there's a difference between utility and cash. And so I think that as we've grown as a business, we've started to be more pragmatic in terms of our decision making and not let emotions cloud it. Like we used to, the arguments that we'd have about like looking back on like the most, like the minutia, like we spent hours debating every single word that was going to end up on our can. And now it's like, I got bigger problems to think about, man. I don't care what that copy says, just get it down and let's move on to the next thing. And part of that is recognizing like, okay, what really matters? And does, you know, comma placement in that, you know, does should we use an Oxford comma or not? The answer is yes, we should. But is that something that we're going to get hung up on when it's time to like proof can plates that are going to ultimately print our cans? And so that I think that you move on to a level where you kind of focus your time and your effort and the emotion, if you will, on the stuff that really matters. And then you have to like really be pragmatic about the other stuff, which is, hey man, we have a deadline to get this thing to the printer to be able to launch this product when we plan to launch it. And that's a very different, it's just an entirely different thing, right? In terms of even flexibility and planning. Like I'd have an idea on Tuesday and by Friday we'd have a product in motion. And we're trying to preserve that because that flexibility and innovation is what drives, you know, American craft beer and certainly craft cider and spirits. And so that's why people love what we do. But now we have to be a lot more deliberate. We have to make, I mean, we're talking about our 2020 lineup already. And so that, you know, in that situation, you're making decisions that are, okay, this isn't going to be a couple hundred cases that Watkins can go hand sell out of the truck. And when you're that small, like I knew I could get it sold. When you get a little bigger and you're forecasting a summer launch, that's a lot of liquid for us. And so you want to make decisions that are going to stick.
Definitely. So two more quick questions before we move on to the quick fire. Do you have an entrepreneurial hero? If so, who is that?
Oh, Well, yes, I do. I mean, it's my dad's an entrepreneur. I watched him do it. And I say, you know, I'll say this with a caveat. Like, I think that you can have a hero and recognize that the way that they do things doesn't have to be the way that you do things. And so, you know, I think that part of the reasons why he's been my hero is just that spirit of, okay, you can do anything. You can go, you have an idea, there's a way for you to execute this. And I got to watch him do that with his business. And we had a lot, you know, the whole family was involved. My mom's brothers and sisters were involved with his business. And so I got to watch that. And then I got to see the good parts of that and then also see the bad parts. But in terms of like, and then I'll also like, I have some brand heroes that are now kind of a little bit more removed from the entrepreneur that started them. But like, I am a huge fan of Patagonia as a business. I also happen to wear too much of their gear, but I think that if you haven't read Let My People Go Surfing, I would strongly recommend it. I think that they've like Patagonia and many other like outdoor and adventure sport type businesses have built really strong businesses around a culture. And that's very much what it is. And so, you know, we try to take some of those cues and how we build Sociable is, you know, if you have the culture, everything else will flow. And I think that that's a really good example.
I'm definitely going to have to read Let My People Go Surfing, and we'll link it in the show notes so everyone else can take a look at it. So that's a good suggestion. The last normal question I'm going to ask you here is, what advice would you give listeners who want to follow your lead?
All right, so here's my flippant advice. Marry well. I say that jokingly. But in all honesty, having a partner when you're like a life partner, business partner is important, obviously, as well. If you choose to have a partnership structure for your business, but having support from your other half can be really, really important. And my wife was going through residency during this, and for us, what was really interesting is the number of her like surgery resident friends that were having like conflicts in their relationship because the significant other was, had a regular 9-to-5. Why aren't you home at 6 o'clock for dinner? And for us, like it was a joke, like who was going to get home later. And so there was I had a partner that understood where I was. And there were some parallels in terms of the path that she was taking, the path that I was taking. And as a result, like, you know, we were able to maximize our time together. And then also now that, you know, she was on a pathway where, you know, docs don't, there's no such thing as unemployed doctors unless they want to be, or they did something really wrong. There's a pipeline that exists, and it is the opposite of entrepreneurship, right? There is a path that you have to spend X amount of money to get the training. And then there's an expected payout over a 20 or 30 year career on the back end. And it is very stable, notwithstanding any potential like healthcare policy shifts, versus entrepreneurship is very unstable. And so I think that having that, you know, us being able to take a risk at Sociable, because I knew that if it didn't go perfectly well, that I would have some support from a partner, was really, really important. And it's, I mean, support to the level of like when I'm filling out loan docs from the bank, they're like, do you own or rent? And my response is always, well, I kind of squat. I just live at my wife's house. and there's a part of that if you don't recognize if you don't recognize that as something that contributes to your success, you're just not looking at the whole picture. And so I think that that's, and again, that doesn't necessarily mean you have to like, you know, marry somebody that can support you emotionally and financially, but, knowing that, you know, so, like that support is important when you're starting this. I mean, this is hard. This is a lot of work. And there's times when you're like sitting there, like wondering if you're going to make payroll. And you have to find some personal source for the fortitude to be able to do that. And for me, that's been Annie and the support that she's given me.
Yeah. And I think it's really important for people to understand, essentially you're picking, if you're going the entrepreneurial route, or even if you're going some executive route in a corporate world, you need to pick a partner that you're going to go to battle with, because, and you guys have to be on the same page from the beginning. Because it's going to be real hard if you get married and all of a sudden you're gone working away trying to make things work, because you have to. Mm-hmm. You just have to. And if you guys aren't on the same page, there's going to be a lot of fights. That is for sure.
No doubt. And also, like, you got to think about what does it mean if this fails? Like, I think that any good trader, any good entrepreneur looks at the, you know, you look at the upside, you look at the downside, and you try to hedge your risk, and you try to like be ready for be ready to maximize your profit if it goes the way that you want it to. But part of that question needs to be, okay, what happens if Sociable didn't make it through the woods? Like, the startup capital on a business like this is high. And as you scale, you add more equipment, and that adds debt payments and all these things. And if you don't get the, distribution scale you think, what happens? And so part of that is knowing that, like, if you need to regroup or you need to pivot or whatever those things are, that your partner is not going to be standing there asking, like, what the heck, man? Like, you're not pulling your weight. And so for us, it was understanding, like, Annie, you're going to block and tackle and I'm swinging for the fences. Sorry to mix my sports analogies there. And so if this doesn't go great for us on this side, like, we know what the downside looks like. It looks like, you know, Annie being the primary breadwinner and me helping with this young boy that's coming in 3 weeks. And versus, like, what does it look like with the upside? Which means, all right, that means that dad's going to be on the road a little bit more as he grows the distribution footprint. And that, you know, it also changes, like, you know, what sociable looks like just within the community.
So awesome. We're going to run through these quick fire questions because.
Yeah. And I'll try to be quick. I don't know if you noticed, but I say what should be said in 3 words in 20. So
I'm so happy that your answers are longer. And don't worry, if you want to expand on some of these questions, don't worry about it. I don't think our audience is going to be too disappointed. The first random question we got here is, what is one problem that you face in your life right now that you wish you could make go away?
Ooh, I've got two Irish wolfhounds, and for some reason recently both of them have been just like bolting anytime they see something move. And I really want that to go away. That is a not business related question, but it gives me and one of the reasons why I've been thinking so much about it is, like, all right, if I can't get these dogs to listen to what I'm saying, like, how am I going to raise this kid? So, I'm thinking very much about how do you exercise influence in a compassionate way, in a way that it gets what you want, but do that in a way that works for your dog, works for your kid, works for your, you know, for your staff, et cetera.
Love it. Second quick fire question. What skills does a young professional need to have straight out of college?
The best thing, in my opinion, the best thing that you can be good at is thinking, reading, and writing. When you're building your business plan, how you articulate that, how you write about that is going to be important. I have a liberal arts background. I think that I would always joke that Carleton College, this great little liberal arts college in Northfield, Minnesota, perfectly prepares you to be able to not get a job when you graduate. And that is actually, like, really, probably really, really accurate. Like, I was a terrible, like, I mean, I'm talking terrible trader from my first 6 months on the desk. And I was a really good one after that. But it took 6 months of me, like, recognizing that I didn't know anything. I didn't know how to make a two-sided market, but I knew what I didn't know. And I think that if you think critically and you're self-aware and you're a strong reader and you can articulate your thoughts, it's easy for you to understand what you don't know and then to rectify that. And I think that's there's not a lot of people that have that.
Awesome answer. And you're hitting all of these out of the ballpark. I'm just selfishly loving this one. So the third quick fire question, what do you believe needs to be sacrificed for success? We kind of already touched on it, but you want to sum it up again?
I'm going to say that, like, your, like, personal pride needs to be, like, sacrificed. There's times when, the easy answer is to say that it's time or flexibility or all those things. And I don't think that's necessarily the case if you structure your life properly and you set the appropriate boundaries and you're being efficient with your time. I think a lot of people aren't very efficient with their time. But I think that pride and authorship is one of the things that can be the biggest detriment for a business. And I had to learn how to overcome that. Like, Killen Spoke Wrench, one of our original flagship products, was way more emotionally difficult than it should have been for me. And it was because I had a pride in authorship. And so it was difficult for me to look at the numbers and say, gosh, as much as you like this thing and as interesting as it is, and, you know, it's like one of your babies and it was the OG concept and all those things. Sometimes you have to make a pragmatic decision and you got to not have that pride in authorship. And I think that really good organizations, in my opinion, are ones that draw on all the available data, and pride can keep you from doing that.
Cool, cool. Last one. What is one life hack student of business should apply to their life this week?
Ooh, life hack. Okay, I'm going to give you the recipe for turbo coffee. You ready?
Okay.
All right, so this sounds gross. It's the same. It's like the cucumber habanero cider. Just trust me and do it. You got to get your blender out. You brew yourself a small, like a 6 or 8 ounce cup of coffee. Crack a raw egg into it. You can use the egg white if the whole egg grosses you out. Tablespoon of butter and then honey to sweetness, and then you blend it up and it gives you this frothy meringue cream on top of a coffee that has, like, Longbourn and slow burn calories that'll get you till about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. It is magical. And if you're an athlete, if you're a cyclist, like I always turbo coffee before I'm going for a long ride. It's a remarkable thing. I cannot recommend it strongly enough for anybody that's going to have a long day where we're getting hangry might be a risk.
Really? I've never heard of that.
There's kind of more like kind of la-di-da health food ways to make it. Like you can put avocado oil instead of the butter or put flaxseed and things like that in it. But the key is you want sugar, which for me is a lot. You want some sugar, you want some fat, and you want some protein. Blend it all together and it's like a coffee milkshake. It's hard to beat.
So it actually tastes okay?
Oh man, it's glorious. It's like if you like a latte, if you like that like frothy, creamy, like meringue top meringue. That's a thing, man. Like that's how you make this like one of the most delicious desserts of all time. Is you whip egg whites with sugar, and so imagine that on top of your coffee. It's glorious.
That's awesome. I'd have to say this is the first life hack I've heard on the show that I am gonna instantly try.
That's what I'm going for, man. I don't want to give crummy advice. Like people should be able to use this.
That's awesome. So before I let you go, you have any ask of the audience, any way for them to reach out to you, and we'll put it all in the show notes as well. But
there. If you're interested in seeing what's happening at Sociable, we're on the usual suspects for social media at Sociable Cider. Started doing a blog. We're starting to document some of our longer term like kind of projects and ideas and aspirations, and telling some of these stories. So you can check that out on the website as well, and stop in and check us out at the tap room. If you like it, we'd love to hear. If you don't like it, we'd love to hear also. We want to know. We're always trying to get better.
That's awesome. Well, Jim, thank you so much for joining us on the show. It has been an absolute blast for me.
Thanks. Thanks very much for having me in, and maybe next time we'll do it in person so we can share a pint.
Sounds good.
All right. Thanks very much.
All right, everyone. Did I overpromise in that opening of the podcast, or was that not one of the greatest episodes Master of the Start has ever done? I seriously loved it. Before I let you go and before I do my final reminders, if you can think of anyone that you believe would be a great, great, great guest to have on the show, do us a favor this week and reach out. Email me personally at Bobby, B-O-B-B-Y, at GoMahi, GoMahi.com. And let me know who you think would be a good guest. Or even if you don't know someone personally, if you have any suggestions of who you'd like to hear on the show, let us know who that'd be, and we'll try to reach out to them and get them on. The second thing before I go into the reminders from this podcast, I didn't really say it in the beginning because I was too excited for the show, but make sure you subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Spotify, iHeart, or Google Play. It'd mean the world to us. We'd love it. We can keep doing great work, or what we describe as great work. We can keep doing these interviews if you guys are actually finding some value from them. If you actually subscribe to the podcast and it's actually worth it for all of you, then it'll continue to be worth it for us. So subscribe this week, leave us a comment, and even if you don't leave us a comment, at least do something to help us out. Like the show. Send us a personal email, whatever it is. We just want to hear your feedback. We want to make sure you're actually enjoying what we're doing. We'll only be able to make the content better, the podcast better for all of you, if you guys give us some feedback. So, without further ado, the reminders from this week's episode of Masters of the Start. Number one, find yourself a significant other who will fully support your business aspirations. He or she will be your partner in crime and will provide emotional and possibly financial backing as you pursue your dreams. The second thing, here's your weekly life hack. Make yourself turbo coffee this week. Blend together 6 to 8 ounces of coffee with an egg, a tablespoon of butter, and honey to sweeten things up. I personally, now that I just heard this amazing weekly life hack, actually I can't call it amazing yet because I haven't tested it, but I will definitely be doing this tomorrow morning. I'm excited to see how it works. I'm excited to see if it's a game changer in my life. So make sure you try it as well this week. We'll see you next week on the Master of the Start podcast. Have a good one, everyone.